From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The wealth and plenty of California agribusiness are built atop the suffering of generations of California farm workers. Farm labor history across America is one shameful tale after another of hardship and exploitation. Malnutrition among migrant children.
The words of Cesar Chavez, read by Marissa Tomei.
At 14, I went to work in a railroad shop. At 16, I was firing a freight engine on a railroad. I remember all the hardships and privations of the earlier day, and from that time until now, my heart has been with the working class. I could have been in Congress long ago. I've preferred to go to prison.
Kurt Vonnegut reading Eugene V. Debs, who ran for president from his cell, and
who will revere the black woman? Who will keep our neighborhood safe for black innocent womanhood? Black womanhood is outraged and humiliated. Black womanhood cries for dignity and restitution and salvation. Black womanhood wants and needs protection and keeping and holding.
Abby Lincoln, as read by Alice Walker, all part of the celebration of Howard Zinn's millionth copy of People's History of the United States, today on our May Day special. So, welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A long-awaited U.S.-backed peace plan for the Middle East was published last night. Only hours after the new Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas was sworn in, he and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon were given copies of the so-called roadmap to peace. Washington had demanded Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat be replaced with Abbas before Washington would restart the peace process. The roadmap was drawn up by the U.S., Russia, the European Union, and the United Nations. The three-stage plan leads to a two-state solution. Palestinians are required to combat violence against Israelis, adopt a new constitution, and recognize the Jewish state's right to exist in peace and security. Israel must withdraw from the recently occupied Palestinian areas, end curfews and roadblocks, halt the expansion of Jewish settlements, and dismantle illegal outposts, stop the demolition of Palestinian homes and confiscation of land, and commit to the creation of a viable Palestinian state to be established within 3 years. The Palestinians say both sides must meet their commitments in parallel by the deadline of June 2003, and most foreign countries agree, but the Israeli government's insisting Palestinians meet the test of combating terror before Israel's required to do anything. The London Guardian reports the Israelis also want to say in judging the Palestinian efforts and have threatened to abandon the roadmap entirely if they don't get their way. The quartet of foreign players behind the process fear that could effectively hand a veto to the Israelis or to any suicide bomber. Secretary of State General Colin Powell is planning to travel to Israel and the occupied territories next week to lobby for the roadmap. Hours after the publication of the peace plan, Israeli troops killed 8 Palestinians in Gaza City, including a 2-year-old and 2 teenagers. The Agence France-Presse is reporting the toddler was shot in the head. 60 Israeli tanks, armored troop carriers, and helicopters invaded the city and attacked an apartment building housing dozens of people. Israeli military sources say they're after a senior Hamas leader, that 7 soldiers have been injured, and that a pitch battle is still going on. Israeli helicopters have begun shelling the area. Many people are trapped inside. The AFP reached a woman trapped in the building who reported that women, children, and elderly people are screaming and crying. In the West Bank, Israeli soldiers shot dead 2 other Palestinians, and it's emerged that a suicide bomber and his accomplice, who killed 3 people and injured scores at a Tel Aviv bar, may be British. Israeli officials say they carried British passports and traveled to Israel specifically to carry out the suicide mission. Attackers lobbed 2 grenades over a wall and into a compound of U.S. troops in Fallujah today. injuring 7 soldiers. The attack comes just hours after the U.S. troops fired into a crowd of Iraqi protesters for the 2nd time this week. 18 Iraqis were killed, over 60 injured in the 2 attacks. Captain Frank Rosenblatt said U.S. troops opened fire on men seen fleeing the area, but no one was captured or believed hit. Rosenblatt also said U.S. troops fired on Iraqi protesters yesterday when the soldiers thought the protesters were hurling grenades. They were actually throwing rocks and slippers. The Iraqi attack comes after religious leaders met with U.S. troops. The leaders asked for the troops to withdraw from the city center and warned they would not be able to control the people much longer. All of this comes as President Bush is planning to address the nation tonight to announce the end of major combat operations in Iraq. He'll say the reconstruction phase has begun. Bush will deliver his speech from the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln, which is returning from the invasion of Iraq. The White House has asked all the networks to carry the address. The London Independent is calling the spectacle a production the White House might have borrowed from Hollywood. Bush will arrive on a plane flown by 4 top Navy pilots, which will require a cable-assisted landing. His appearance is scheduled for 9 p.m. prime time on the East Coast. It'll be the first time a president has addressed this country from an aircraft carrier at sea. Bush administration officials say the president will not say directly that the conflict is entirely over. White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer said, quote, "This is not, from a legal point of view, the end of hostilities. Clearly, we continue to have forces that are shot at and return fire." If Bush decided to declare victory, the U.S. would be required under the Geneva Conventions to release all prisoners of war and cease all operations aimed at individual enemy leaders. Senior military officers from 12 nations met in London yesterday for talks on how to turn the Anglo-American occupation of Iraq into a broader coalition. The talks were by invitation only, the guest list not disclosed. The London Independent reports nations who oppose the invasion are not included in the discussion on an international security force. The United Nations was entirely sidelined. Poland and Denmark confirmed they attended. Italy and Spain are also thought to have participated. A U.S. Marine sergeant's under investigation for possible war crimes committed in Iraq based on statements he made to his hometown newspaper. Gunnery Sergeant Gus Covarrubias described for the Las Vegas Review-Journal how he hunted down and shot 2 Iraqi soldiers. Covarrubias said he found an Iraqi soldier with a grenade launcher, ordered the man to stop and to turn around, and shot him twice in the back of the head. He shot another Iraqi who was trying to escape. Then he took their ID cards, a rifle, and one of their berets for souvenirs. The Washington Post reporting the Bush administration has stepped up efforts at the UN to stifle criticism of U.S. policies in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other foreign countries. This according to a confidential U.S. diplomatic communication and senior UN diplomats. At the height of the conflict in Iraq, the administration successfully blocked debate in the UN General Assembly on an Arab-sponsored resolution criticizing the invasion. Earlier this month, it sought to restrict discussion of human rights violations in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's currently trying to derail an initiative by the president of the General Assembly to establish a forum to openly debate current foreign policy issues. The administration's efforts reflects concern among some U.S. officials that the United Nations may emerge as a major platform for dissent against U.N. foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy, at a time when the United States is expanding its global military reach. The administration's campaign has included public rebukes of senior U.N. officials, including Kofi Annan. The U.S. has approved a request from U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Negroponte, for a $600,000 renovation to his kitchen. Officials told the Agence France-Presse Negroponte asked for the funds to remodel and expand the kitchen at the apartment in New York's famed Waldorf Astoria. An official said the U.S. is, quote, in this for the long haul regarding U.S. participation in the United Nations. Fortune magazine's reporting Donald Rumsfeld has some important connections to North Korea that he hasn't wanted to talk about very much. Rumsfeld sat on the board of the Zurich-based engineering giant ABB when the firm was awarded a $200 million contract to provide the design and key components for North Korea's nuclear reactors. In addition, one of ABB's directors told Fortune magazine that Rumsfeld was asked to lobby Washington on ABB's behalf in the mid-1990s. Newsweek's reporting Bush administration officials are waging a behind-the-scenes battle to prevent the public disclosure of 800-page secret congressional report detailing the intelligence and law enforcement failures that preceded the September 11th attacks, including provocative, unheeded warnings that President Bush and his top advisors were given in the months before the attacks. The report was completed last December, but only a bare-bones list of so-called findings with virtually no details was made public. And nearly 6 months later, Bush administration intelligence officials are refusing to declassify many of its most significant conclusions and are even seeking to reclassify some material that's already been discussed in public testimony. This is White House political aides are plotting a 2004 presidential election campaign designed to capitalize on the emotions raised by the attacks. And the residents of Vieques today are celebrating the U.S. Navy's withdrawal from the Puerto Rican island. Fireworks shot into the sky last night. A minute before the official midnight deadline, protesters broke down a fence at the entrance to the bombing range, and hundreds flowed in, blowing horns and waving the blue and white flag of Vieques. Some stole Navy vehicles, drove them to the gate, and smashed the lights and windows with sledgehammers. For 60 years, the Navy's bombed the island. The Navy handed over 15,000 acres of land with no fanfare, just a written statement. Hundreds of activists who were jailed for trespassing to stop the bombing are now preparing for their next battle, reclaiming lands transferred yesterday to the Department of Interior, which will transform the range into a wildlife refuge.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, so I followed the mark.
Odetta and Dr. John singing Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? By Yip Harburg. You are listening to Democracy Now! In our May Day special. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, May Day, International Workers' Day, formed to commemorate the historic struggle of working people throughout the world. On this May Day, we are going to dedicate the hour to the history of the United States viewed through the eyes of workers and the people. We're going to spend the hour with Kurt Vonnegut, Alice Walker, Marissa Tomei, James Earl Jones, Patti Smith, and others as they read excerpts from Howard Zinn's classic work, A People's History of the United States. They all gathered recently at the 92nd Street Y in New York to read from Zinn's book, which has just sold its millionth copy.
What our schools do not say about Helen Keller is that she was a socialist, a radical, that she opposed war and militarism, that she walked on picket lines. But because she was blind, they said that her disability limited her understanding of social issues. The editor of the Brooklyn Eagle, who had once praised her lavishly, changed his mind when she declared herself a socialist, whereupon she wrote a letter to the newspaper addressing it, Poor Blind Eagle. Here she speaks in Carnegie Hall on the eve of America's entrance into the First World War.
Marissa Tomei reading Helen Keller.
We are facing a grave crisis in our national life. The few who profit from the labor of the masses want to organize the workers into an army which will protect the interests of the capitalists. You are urged and asked to add to the heavy burdens you already bear, the burden of a larger army and many additional warships. It is in your power to refuse. Congress is not preparing to defend the people of the United States. It is planning to protect the capital of American speculators and investors in Mexico, South America, China, and the Philippine Islands. Those preparedness propagandists want to give the people something to think about besides their own unhappy condition. Every few days, we are given a new scare to lend realism to their propaganda. People are taught that brave men die for their country's honor. What a price to pay for an abstraction. The lives of millions of young men, other millions crippled and blinded for life. Existence made hideous for still more millions of human beings. The achievement and inheritance of generations swept away in a moment. And nobody better off for all the misery. Strike against the war. Without you, no battles can be fought. Strike against manufacturing bombs and tools of murder. Strike against preparedness that really means death and misery to millions of human beings. Be not dumb, obedient slaves in an army of destruction. Be heroes in an army of construction.
Howard Zinn.
After them.
Eugene Debs led a national strike of railroad workers in 1894 and spent 6 months in jail for that. He went into prison a labor leader and came out a socialist. As leader of the Socialist Party, he ran for president 3 times. When the United States entered the First World War, President Wilson signed the Espionage Act, which provided long jail terms for anyone who said anything that might discourage recruitment in the armed forces. A filmmaker who made a movie about the American Revolution depicting the British as enemies was sentenced to 10 years in prison because now the British were our allies. His film was called The Spirit of 76, and the court case against him was U.S. versus Spirit of 76. Debs spoke against the war, was arrested for violating the Espionage Act, and his conviction was upheld unanimously by the Supreme Court, which pointed to his statement that, quote, the master class has always made the wars, the working class has always fought them. Here, at his trial in the fall of 1918, he is speaking to the court.
Kurt Vonnegut reads Eugene V. Debs.
Your Honor, years ago I recognized my kinship with all living beings, and I made up my mind that I was not one bit better than the meanest on earth. I said then, and I say now, that while there is a lower class, I am in it, and while there is a criminal element, I am of it, and while there is a soul in prison, I am not free. Your Honor, I have stated in this court that I am opposed to the social system in which we live, that I believe in a fundamental change, but if possible, by peaceable and orderly means. Standing here this morning, I recall my boyhood. At 14, I went to work in a railroad shop. At 16, I was firing a freight engine on a railroad. I remember all the hardships and privations of the earlier day, and from that time until now, my heart has been with the working class. I could have been in Congress long ago. I've preferred to go to prison. I am thinking this morning of the men in the mills and the factories, the men in the mines and on the railroads. I'm thinking of the women who, for a paltry wage, are compelled to work out their barren lives, of the little children who in this system are robbed of their childhood and in their tender years are seized in the remorseless grasp of mammon and forced into the industrial dungeons, there to feed the monster machines while they themselves are being starved and stunted, body and soul. I see them dwarfed and diseased, and their little lives broken and blasted, because in this high noon of Christian civilization, money is still much more important than the flesh and blood of childhood. In very truth, gold is the god today, and rules with pitiless sway in the affairs of men. I am opposing a social order in which it is possible for one man who does absolutely nothing that is useful to amass a fortune of hundreds of millions of dollars, while millions of men and women who work all the days of their lives secure barely enough for a wretched existence. This order of things cannot always endure. I have registered my protest against it. I recognize the feebleness of my effort, but fortunately, I am not alone. I can see the dawn of a better day for humanity. The people are awakening. In due time, they will and must come into their own.
Kurt Vonnegut reading Eugene V. Debs. Coming up after our break, Harris Yulin, Andre Gregory, Alfre Woodard, James Earl Jones, Danny Glover, Alice Walker, and others here on the reading of the millionth copy of People's History of the United States. Stay with us.
Once I built a railroad, I made it run. Made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower.
Odetta and Dr. John singing Brother Can You Spare a Dime, Yip Harburg. On this May Day, we return to Howard's Inn.
When Studs Terkel published his interviews with veterans of the Second World War, he put the title, The Good War, in quotation marks. He was recognizing that in the perspective of history, there were questions raised about the Good War, about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, about Dresden and Tokyo, about the indiscriminate bombing of civilian populations, about the ultimate value of any war, however noble the cause. War was always the killing of innocents, civilians and soldiers. And the military, however good the war, was always corrupt and contained in the best of situations elements of fascism. In his novel Catch-22, Joseph Heller captured the absurdity and cruelty that pervades military life. In this passage, Yossarian's friend Clevenger is facing military justice.
Justice? The colonel was astounded. What is justice? Justice, sir, that's not what justice is. The colonel jeered and began pounding the table again with his big fat hand. That's what Karl Marx is. I'll tell you what justice is. Justice is a knee in the gut with a knife. Sandbagged in the dark without a word of warning. Garroting. That's what justice is. From the hip. Get it? Clevenger was guilty, of course, or he would not have been accused. And since the only way to prove it was to find him guilty, it was their patriotic to do so. But it was very confusing to Clevenger. There were many strange things taking place. But the strangest of all to Clevenger was a hatred. The brutal, uncloaked, inexorable hatred of members of the action board. They were three grown men, and he was a boy, and they hated him, and they wished him dead. Yossarian had done his best to warn him the night before. You haven't got a chance, kid, he told him glumly. They hate Jews. But I'm not Jewish, answered Clevenger. It will make no difference, Yossarian promised. And Yossarian was right. They're after everybody. Clevenger recoiled from the hatred as though from the blinding light. These three men who hated him spoke his language, wore his uniform, but he saw their loveless faces set immutably into cramped, mean lines of hostility, and understood instantly that nowhere in the world, not in all the fascist tanks or planes or submarines, not even among all the expert gunners of the crack Hermann Goering anti-aircraft division, or among the grisly connivers in all the beer halls in Munich and everywhere else, nowhere were there men who hated him more.
Kurt Vonnegut reading Catch-22, Howard Zinn.
No. The end of World War II brought no peace, but an arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union and an intense fear of communism pervading American society. Abroad, it took the form of seeing every revolutionary movement as part of a world communist conspiracy. At home, there was a near hysterical search for communist influence everywhere, leading to loyalty oaths for government employees, secret FBI surveillance of hundreds of thousands of Americans, and congressional inquisitions into the political ideas and affiliations of educators and people in the arts. The House Committee on Un-American Activities decided there was communist influence in the film industry. Informers named actors and directors as members of the Communist Party, and these were then called before the committee to inform on others under penalty of prison if they did not cooperate or of being blacklisted in their profession. Lionel Stander, veteran Hollywood actor, dueled with the committee.
Does the committee charge me with being a communist?
Mr. Stander, will you let me tell you whether you are charged with being a communist? Will you be quiet just for a minute while I will tell you what you are here for?
Yes, I would like to hear.
You are here to give us information which will enable us to do the work that was assigned to us by the House of Representatives, which is a duty imposed upon us to investigate reports regarding subversive activities in the United States.
Well, I am more than willing to cooperate.
Now, just a minute.
Because I have, and I know, some subversive activities in the entertainment industry and elsewhere in the country.
Mr. Stander, the committee is interested in any subversive knowledge you have.
Well, I have knowledge of subversive action. And I can help the committee if it's really interested.
Mr. Stander,
I know of a group of fanatics who are desperately trying to undermine the Constitution of the United States by depriving artists and others of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness without due process of law. If you're interested in that, I'd like to tell you about it. I can tell names and I can cite instances, and I'm one of the first victims of it. And if you're interested in that, and also a group of ex-Bundists, American firsters, and anti-Semites, people who hate everybody, including Negroes, minority groups, most likely themselves.
Now, Mr. Stander.
And there are people engaged in this conspiracy outside of all the legal processes to undermine our very fundamental American concepts upon which our entire system of jurisprudence rests.
Mr. Stander, unless you begin to answer these questions and act like a witness in a reasonable, dignified manner under the rules of the committee, I will be forced to have you removed from this room.
I am deeply shocked, Mr. Chairman.
Harris Yulin and Andre Gregory. Howard Zinn.
In the summer of 1964, black men and women in Mississippi, joined by 1,000 young volunteers from the North, formed the Freedom Democratic Party in defiance of the all-white Democratic Party of Mississippi. When the Democratic National Convention met in Atlantic City, black activists in the Freedom Democratic Party traveled by bus from Mississippi to demand that black people, who are 40% of the population in Mississippi, should get 40% of the seats at the convention. Fannie Lou Hamer, a sharecropper from Mississippi, spoke to the Credentials Committee, citing her own experience about what happened to black people in Mississippi who tried to vote. Her eloquence on this occasion, nationally televised, so worried President Lyndon Johnson that he issued a White House announcement to interrupt her testimony. The Democratic Party refused to seat the black delegates, instead offering them two non-voting seats, which they refused. Here's a portion of Mrs. Hamer's testimony.
Mr. Chairman and the Credentials Committee, my name is Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, and I live at 626 East Lafayette Street, Ruleville, Mississippi, Sunflower County, the home of Senator James O. Eastland and Senator Stennis. It was the 31st of August in 1962 that 18 of us traveled 26 miles to the county courthouse in Indianola to try to register to vote to become first-class citizens. The plantation owner came and said, "Fannie Lou, if you don't go down and withdraw your registration, you will have to leave because we are not ready for that in Mississippi." And I addressed him and told him, I said, "I didn't go down there to register for you. I went down to register for myself." I had to leave that same night. And in June the 9th, 1963, I had attended a voter registration workshop, was returning back to Mississippi. 10 of us was traveling by Continental Trailway bus. When we got to Winona, Mississippi, there was a state highway patrolman and a chief of police ordered us out. When they found out who I was, they said, "You nigga bitch, we gonna make you wish you were dead." They made me lay on my face and they ordered two Negro prisoners to beat me with a blackjack. That was unbearable. The first prisoner beat me until he was exhausted, and then the second Negro began to beat me. They beat me until I was hard, until I couldn't bend my fingers or get up when they told me to. All of this on account that we wanted to register to vote to become first-class citizens. And if the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off the hooks because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America? I thank you.
Alfre Woodard reading Fannie Lou Hamer, Howard Zinn.
In the struggle for racial equality, not all black people accepted Martin Luther King's message of love and nonviolence. Soon after the 1963 March on Washington, in which King spoke of his dream, four black girls were killed in the bombing of a Birmingham church. For Malcolm X, who grew up in a northern ghetto, spent time in prison, became a Muslim, this pointed up the limitations of the civil rights movement. That fall, he addressed a meeting in Detroit. 2 years later, he would be assassinated.
"As long as the white man sent you to Korea, you bled. He sent you to Germany, you bled. He sent you to the South Pacific to fight the Japanese, you bled. You bleed for the white man. But when it comes to seeing your own churches being bombed and little black girls murdered, you haven't got any blood. You bleed when the white man says bleed. You bite when the white man says bite, and you bark when the white man says bark. I hate to say this about us, but it's true. How are you going to be nonviolent in Mississippi and violent as you were in Korea? How can you justify being nonviolent in Mississippi and Alabama when your churches are being bombed and your little girls are being murdered. If violence is wrong in America, violence is wrong abroad. If it is wrong to be violent defending black women and black children and black babies and black men, then it is wrong for America to draft us and make us violent abroad to defend her. And if it is right for America to draft us and teach us how to be violent in defense of her, then it is right for you and me to do whatever is necessary to defend our own people right here in this country. Right at that time, Birmingham had exploded. That's when Kennedy sent in the troops down in Birmingham. After that, Kennedy got on the television and said, "This is a moral issue." That's when he said he was going to put out a civil rights bill. When he mentioned civil rights bill, and the Southern crackers started talking about how they were going to boycott and filibuster it, then the Negroes started talking about how they were going to march on Washington, march on the Senate, march on the White House, march on the Congress, tie it up, bring it to a halt, not let the government proceed. They even said they were going to go out to the airport and lie down on the runway, not let any airplanes land. I'm telling you what they said. That was revolution. That was revolution. That was the black revolution. It was the grassroots out there in the street. It scared the white man to death, scared the white power structure in Washington, D.C. to death. I was there when they found out this black steamroller was going to come down on the Capitol. They called in those national Negro leaders that you respect and said, "Call it off." Kennedy said, "Look, you're letting this go too far." And old Tom said, "Boss, I can't stop it because I didn't start it." I'm telling you what they said. They said, "I'm not even in it, much less at the head of it." They said, "These Negroes are doing things on their own."
James Earl Jones reading Malcolm X. Back to historian Howard Zinn.
Many of the national leaders of the civil rights movement thought they should not speak out about the war in Vietnam, that this would hurt the cause of black people. But Martin Luther King Jr. decided he could not be silent. April 4th, 1967, he spoke at the Riverside Church in New York.
"I come to this magnificent house of worship tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relationship to Vietnam. In 1957, when a group of us formed the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, we chose as our motto, 'To save the soul of America.' In a way, we were green with Langston Hughes, the black bard of Harlem, who had written earlier, 'Oh yes, I say it plain, America was never America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be.' Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and dealt death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as one who loves America, to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours. I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-orientated society to a person-orientated society. When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplet of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasy on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hand on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world.
Danny Glover reading the words of Martin Luther King. From Howard Zinn's book, People's History of the United States. Coming up, Alice Walker reading Abby Lincoln, but now we'll go to Abby Lincoln herself singing Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, and now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
And that was Abby Lincoln here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we return to Howard Zinn reading from his book, People's History of the United States.
The rebellious spirit of the 60s showed itself not only in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, but an unprecedented emergence of a movement for gay and lesbian rights, and also an exciting new movement for the rights of women. Too often that movement spoke for white women, but here, Abby Lincoln, the jazz singer, speaks for women of color.
We are the women who were kidnapped and brought to this continent as slaves. We are the women who were raped or still being raped, and our bastard children snatched from our breasts and scattered to the winds to be lynched, castrated, de-egoed, robbed, burned, and deceived. We are the women whose strong and beautiful black bodies were and are still being used as a cheap labor force for Miss Ann's kitchen and Mr. Charlie's bed, whose rich black and warm milk nurtured and still nurtures the heir to the racist and evil slave master. We are the women who dwell in the hellhole ghettos all over the land. We are the women whose bodies are sacrificed as living cadavers to experimental surgery in the white man's hospitals for the sake of white medicine.
We are the women who are invisible on the television and movie screens and on the Broadway stage. We are the women who are lusted after, sneered at, leered at, hissed at, yelled at, grabbed at, tracked down by white degenerates in our own pitiable, poverty-stricken, and prideless neighborhoods. We are the women whose hair is compulsively fried, whose skin is bleached, whose nose is too big, whose mouth is too big and loud, whose behind is too big and broad, whose feet are too big and flat, whose face is too black and shiny, and whose suffering and patience is too long and enduring to be believed. Who are just too damn much for everybody. Who will revere the black woman? Who will keep our neighborhood safe for black innocent womanhood? Black womanhood is outraged and humiliated. Black womanhood cries for dignity and restitution and salvation. Black womanhood wants and needs protection and keeping and holding. Who will assuage her indignation? Who will keep her precious and pure? Who will glorify and proclaim her beautiful image? To whom will she cry rape?
Alice Walker reading Abby Lincoln. Howard Zinn.
Thank you. In the 60s, farm workers on the West Coast began to organize against the powerful growers. In 1966, the Farm Workers Union led a 300-mile march to Sacramento to call attention to the strike of grape workers. A national boycott of grapes was remarkably successful in forcing the growers to negotiate with the workers. Through it all, Cesar Chavez, president of the United Farm Workers of America, was a charismatic and effective leader. Here is a speech of his in 1989 calling attention to the plight of farm workers.
What is the worth of a man or a woman? What is the value of a farm worker? How do you measure the value of a life? Ask the parents of Johnny Rodriguez. Johnny Rodriguez wasn't even a man. Johnny was a five-year-old boy when he died after a painful two-year battle against cancer. His parents, Juan and Aaliyah, are farm workers. Like all grape workers, they are exposed to pesticides and other agricultural chemicals. Aaliyah worked in the table grapes around Delano, California, until she was 8 months pregnant with Johnny. The wealth and plenty of California agribusiness are built atop the suffering of generations of California farm workers. Farm labor history across America is one shameful tale after another of hardship and exploitation. Malnutrition among migrant children, tuberculosis, pneumonia, and respiratory infections, average life expectancy more than 20 years below the U.S. norm. When farm workers organize against these injustices, they are met with brutality and coercion and death. Who will protect farm workers from poisoning if it isn't the Farm Workers Union? The Environmental Protection Agency won't do it. The law won't do it. Oscar Wilde once said, "A cynic is someone who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing." We look at the price. We don't look at the value. Economics and profit drive everything. Do we carry in our hearts the suffering of farm workers and their children? Do we feel their pain deeply enough? The answer lies with you and me. It is with all men and women who share the suffering and yearn with us for a better world.
Marissa Tomei reading Cesar Chavez. Back to historian Howard Zinn, author of People's History of the United States.
Early in 1991, President George Bush Sr. sent American troops into Iraq, presumably to liberate Kuwait from the control of Saddam Hussein, more likely to assure American power in the oil-rich countries of the Middle East. The government had learned from the Vietnam experience that an anti-war movement must not be allowed time to develop, that U.S. casualties must be kept low, and that information about the war must be controlled. A massive air attack quickly defeated the forces of Saddam Hussein, and the American people were kept ignorant of the large numbers of casualties among Iraqi civilians. Nevertheless, a protest movement developed, and there were refusals among the military to participate in the war. A Navy Reserve Corpsman named James Lawrence Harrington wrote a letter of resignation to his commander.
There comes a time in life when maintaining silence is but a betrayal of one's own spiritual core of being. Such a time has come, and I must declare from the expansion of my heart and over the limited sphere of my mind that I am a conscientious objector opposed to any and all wars. The power and command of my faith dictates that I work diligently and completely to stop war. To this end do I dedicate the efforts of my life. I do not hold that the absence of participation in war is itself a peace. Through the power of the people, peace is an active force that can and must spread to all nations, including our own. Our nation suffers from a deep malady in its consciousness that leads it down the path of continual violence and strife. I seek not only to stop this impending war in the Persian Gulf, but to also treat our own profound sickness. War is but a symptom of a greater concern. I prescribe the treatment of a radical revolution within our nation from that of a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented community. We must learn to love and respect all people for the sake of the divinity and basic goodness that dwells within them. When we deny people the right to exist and to self-determination, we are assuring our own self-destruction. In order to save my nation, and in order not to betray my own soul, I take this open stance of opposition to all wars.
Howard Zinn's son, Jeff Zinn, reading the resignation letter of James Lawrence Harrington during the Gulf War. Back to Howard Zinn.
The administration of Ronald Reagan began an attack on welfare, on aid to single mothers, on food stamps, on health care for the poor. That attack would culminate during the Clinton administration with the ending of federal guarantees to families with dependent children. In the early Reagan years, a mother wrote to a local newspaper responding to the claim that government was not needed, that private enterprise, the so-called free market, would take care of poverty.
I am an aide to families with dependent children, and both my children are in school. I have graduated from college with distinction, 128th in a class of over 1,000, with a BA in English and sociology. I have experience in library work, child care, social work, and counseling. I have applied for jobs paying as little as $8,000 a year. I work part-time in a library for $3.50 an hour. Welfare reduces my allotment to compensate. It appears we have employment offices that can't employ, governments that can't govern, and an economic system that can't produce jobs for people ready to work. Last week, I sold my bed to pay for the insurance on my car, while in the absence of mass transportation, I need to go job hunting. I sleep on a piece of rubber foam somebody gave me. So this is the great American dream my parents came to this country for. Work hard, get a good education, follow the rules, and you'll be rich. I don't want to be rich. I just want to be able to feed my children with some semblance of dignity.
That was Alfred Woodard, Howardson.
Immediately after the terrorist attack on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon on September 11, 2001, President George Bush proclaimed a war on terrorism, and soon after began the bombardment of Afghanistan. But some of the families who had lost loved ones in the attack refused to support what the government was doing and formed a group called Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. The family of Phyllis and Orlando Rodriguez, whose son Greg was among the many missing from the World Trade Center, wrote to the New York Times, "We sense that our government is heading in a direction of violent revenge. It is not the way to go. It will not avenge our son's death, not in our son's name." A woman named Amber Amundson sent a statement to the Chicago Tribune.
"My husband, Craig Scott Amundson of the U.S. Army, lost his life in the line of duty at the Pentagon on September 11th, as the world looked on in horror and disbelief. Losing my 28-year-old husband and father of our two young children is a terrible and painful experience. I have heard angry rhetoric by some Americans, including some of our nation's leaders, who advise a heavy dose of revenge and punishment. To those leaders, I would like to make clear that my family and I take no comfort in your words of rage. If you choose to respond to this incomprehensible brutality by perpetuating violence against other innocent human beings, you may not do so in the name of my husband. Craig would not have wanted a violent response to avenge his death, and I cannot see how good can come of it. We cannot solve violence by violence. Mohandas Gandhi said, an eye for an eye only makes the whole world blind. I call upon our nation's leaders to find the courage to respond to this incomprehensible tragedy by breaking the cycle of violence. I call on them to marshal this great nation's skills and resources to lead a worldwide dialogue from freedom, from terror and hate."
Myla Pitts reading the letter from Amber Amundson about her husband, Craig Scott Amundson, who died at the Pentagon on September 11, 2001. And that does it for today's May Day special, readings from People's History of the United States. The millionth copy has been published and sold, all directed by historian Howardson. Our website is democracynow.org. Our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qadus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Reibel. Happy birthday, Noah, and Vilka Tsura. Special thanks to Alex Wolf. Also, Angela Alston, Emily Kunstler, Orlando Richard, Simba Russo, Johnny Sender, Rich Kim, Karen Renucci, Fatima Mojadidi, Dennis Moynihan, and Jenny Filippazzo. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to our May Day special as we go out with Patti Smith, who also performed at the 92nd Street Y reading of People's History of the United States. People have the power.